brahmanas, known as yagic brahmanas. In Kali Yuga, however, there is a scarcity of such brahmanas. Therefore, in Kali Yuga, the sacrifice recommended in Shastra is Sankirtan Yagya. Yagyai Sankirtana Prayar Yajantihi Sumedasaha. Instead of spending money unnecessarily on performing yagyas impossible to perform in this age of Kali because of the scarcity of yagic brahmanas, one who is intelligent performs Sankirtan Yagya. Without properly performed yagyas to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there will be scarcity of rain. Yagyad Bhavati Parjanya. Therefore, the performance of yagya is essential. Without yagya, there will be scarcity of rain, and because of this scarcity, no food grains will be produced, and there will be famines. It is the duty of the king, therefore, to perform different types of yagyas, such as the Ashwamedha Yagya, to maintain the production of food grains. Annad Bhavanti Bhutani. Without food grains, both men and animals will starve. Therefore, yagya is necessary for the state to perform, because by yagya, the people in general will be fed sumptuously. The brahmanas and yagic priests should be sufficiently paid for their expert service. This payment is called dakshina. Maharaj Ambarish Maharaj, as the head of the state, performed all these yagyas through great personalities like Vasishta, Gautama, and Asita. Personally, however, he was engaged in devotional service, as mentioned before. Savaya Manat Krishna Padaravindayo. The king or head of state must see that things go on well under proper guidance. And he must be an ideal devotee, as exemplified by Maharaj Ambarish. It is the duty of the king to see that food grains are produced even in desert countries, what to speak of elsewhere. Om Jnanati Virandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilita Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Ijesha Medhair Adi Yagyam Ishwaram Mahavibhutyo Pachitanga Dakshinaya. Tatair Vasishtasita Gautam Adi Pir Dhanvanya Vishrotam Asau Saraswatim. In desert countries where there flowed the river Saraswati, Maharaj Ambarish performed great sacrifices like the Ashwamedha Yagya and thus satisfied the master of all yagyas, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such sacrifices were performed with great opulence and suitable paraphernalia and with contributions of dakshina to the brahmanas, who were supervised by great personalities like Vasishta, Asita, and Gautama, representing the king, the performer of the sacrifices. This pastime of Ambarish Maharaj is unfolding here. We're hearing just some background on him at this point. Then we'll hear about what took place with Durvasa Muni, which is a central point of this chapter. So here we're hearing something about the personality of Ambarish Maharaj. A couple of verses ago, we heard about how he was constantly engaged in devotional service. All of the things he did are familiar to us. They're very similar, some of them, to the 9 kinds of devotional service described by Prahlad Maharaj. So here we're hearing about what he was like as a king. And included in his activities as a king was performing sacrifices. So here specifically it's said that he performed them where the river Saraswati flowed. I've been thinking recently about, I often have many questions that I don't have answers to. This is another one. Where does Manu live? I don't know where Manu lives. Vaivaswatu Manu. Because we're hearing about his descendants. So Ambarish Maharaj is, see, there was Ambarish, then Nabhaga, then Nabhaga, then Ambarish. So great grandson of Manu. So So where are his activities taking place? His activities are taking place on earth, as we know it, in India, where the Saraswati River flows. Of course, the Saraswati is no longer visible to us. There's research that goes on where people are trying to, they feel that they've, by satellite photos, they're able to see where it might have flowed. Here it says that it flowed in the desert regions. That does correspond with some research that it flows. It seems like it comes out of the Himalayas, maybe in the northwest, comes down and goes through Rajasthan, across North India. And of course, we know that it ends at Triveni, which is Allahabad. Only the Ganga and Yamuna are meeting there now. But it's said that the Saraswati is also there. Triveni means three rivers coming together. So the third river is the Saraswati. And it's said that the Saraswati is flowing underground there to meet the other two. So the Saraswati River is flowing, here it says specifically, desert country. So Rajasthan today is still a desert. What I found interesting and a little confusing to me is that you'd think that if a river is flowing through the desert, then it wouldn't be a desert anymore. In fact, the word used here is abhishtotam, inundated by the water of the river. So in any case, it said that this was the desert region. And specifically, he was performing Ashwamedha Yajna. Now, Ashwamedha means horse sacrifice. In a horse sacrifice, the Prabhupada presents it in different ways, but the basic idea is, one thing he would say about these sacrifices was that the animal was used so that the Brahmins could make sure that they were chanting their mantras properly. So if they couldn't, they would kill the animal, sacrifice the animal. Just like in the Daksha Yajna, Daksha's head was cut off by the guillotine, whatever it is that they use to cut off the animal's head. So Daksha's head was cut off with that. So that would happen. And then the Brahmins are supposed to be so expert that they could revive the animal, make it a young. If it was an old animal, it would become a young animal. I think there may be some reference that the animal would get a human birth in the next life. So these Brahmins had to be expert in performing these sacrifices. Here we see specifically that there were, one thing, Ambarish Maharaj, actually getting back to this point of where Manu lives and where these things take place, it said earlier that Manu had control, either Manu or his sons, they had sovereignty over Saptadweep. The other day we heard the word Mahim, which means the earth. Prabhupada just translates it as the earth. But earlier in the beginning of this chapter, it said that he had the rule over Saptadweep. So I was trying to get this all straight, like probably like most of you, this how the universe is put together is really a bewildering thing. And it seems that Prabhupada says different things in different places. But referring to Sariputta's research, it seems that, as you may know, there was an article that appeared in Bhaktivedanta and also in Sariputta Prabhu's books. He talks about how the Saptadweep, the seven islands, how they seem to correspond, or they do correspond, actually, to the orbits of the planets in the solar system. And Bhumandala, the Saptadweepas, actually there are nine dweeps, but there are seven that are visible, nine islands. They make up Bhumandala. So Bhumandala is what we often is just called Earth. We just refer to it as Earth. Of course, when we think of Earth, we think of this globe. But Bhumandala is described in a different way in the Bhagavatam. So Sariputta, in his research, he says it seems to be that this is referring actually to the orbits of the planets in the what's called the ecliptic. If you've ever seen, of course, I'm sure you've seen pictures of the sun in the middle and then the planets going around. All the planets are pretty much in the same plane. It's not that there's one way up here and one. They're all pretty much in the same plane. That's called the plane of the ecliptic. So Sariputta also explained that when we hear these heights, it says this planet is higher than that planet, the moon is higher than the sun. That refers to how high it is above the ecliptic. The different distances work out quite well. Of course, he did all these calculations. So it would seem that that Manu lives somewhere in this Bhumandala and rules, especially he rules over this area. There's Bhuvar, Swa, so the earthly planets. Prabhupada would also refer to the earthly planets. And I've also always wondered, what does that mean? We know the earth that we're on, so what are the other earthly planets? So it may mean that when he says earthly planets, he's referring to Bhumandala. And within Bhumandala, there are also different statuses of life. There's one purport in the fifth canto where Prabhupada says that there are three heavenly planets. So one can go up to Swargaloka, the heavenly planet of Indra, that area. We generally think about, we perform fruitive activities on earth, and if you're pious and you do the right rituals and so on, you can go there. But there are also heavenly regions in Bhumandala. The Bhumandala, as I said, is made up of different dvipas. So where the center one is Jambudvip. And Jambudvip is where we're situated. And the dvipas are made up of different varshas. And one of those varshas is Bharat Varsha. So sometimes Prabhupada says that Bharat Varsha means this earth, as we understand it. In other places he says that Bharat Varsha means India. And then the other varshas are, there's, you know, the Asian Europe is another varsha and so on. And in fact, in some places, he says that Saptadvipa refers to the seven continents. So when I hear these things, I sometimes think, well, Prabhupada, one of his reasons for doing this may be that he just didn't want us to get too caught up in these things, and it doesn't really matter that much. But I find it interesting to try to understand it. But so at least here in the context of Ambarish Maharaj, and we see it in other pastimes too, they actually take place on the earth and in India. Now, India is called Punya Bhumi, the holy land, holy earth, because, of course, Krishna's avatars descend here, but also many great sages perform their spiritual activities here. So in this, in the context of this verse that we're reading today, we're hearing about a few of these great sages who are assisting in the sacrifice. Now, Ambarish Maharaj, because he's the emperor, he, of course, can call on the best. He can get the all-stars to come to his yajna. So he's got here, it mentions Vasishta. Now Vasishta, in the very beginning of this canto, we heard about Vasishta, the story of King Sujumna and the king that wanted his wife wanted a daughter, but the daughter became a son, and the son became a daughter, and that whole pastime. So Vasishta was involved in that. He was the one who was conducting that sacrifice. We often hear Vasishta present in different sacrifices in many different eras and different yugas. So he's an extremely prominent Vedic sage. Vasishta, Asita. I don't know much about Asita except that he's mentioned in Bhagavad Gita. He's a reference given by Arjuna. Arjuna says, not only do I think that you're the Supreme Personality of Godhead, other great rishis, including Asita, Devala. So Asita is mentioned there as a great authority, great Vedic authority. Arjuna is quoting him as an authority on who God is, that Krishna is God. And Gautam, there are many pastimes of Gautam Rishi described in different places in the Vedic literature. So what's interesting here is it says that they were supervising the others. So we can imagine King Ambarish, he's the king of the world, so he's got all kinds of opulence at his disposal. So he probably has many, many brahmanas conducting sacrifices. We hear in different places how there are different kinds of priests who do different things. So here we see their supervisors, and it says they represent the king in conducting the sacrifice, and they're there to make sure that everything goes on properly. So this particular sacrifice, the Ashwamedha Yajna, which is a horse sacrifice, Ashwamedham Gavalambyam Samyasam Palapaitrakam Devalena Sutotpatim Kalopancha Vivarjayet. It's said that in Kali Yuga, you're not allowed to perform Ashwamedha sacrifice and cow sacrifice. We don't hear much about cow sacrifice. We usually hear about Ashwamedha Yajna, not go made a yajna, but apparently that also took place. And one of the other things you can't do in Kali Yuga is take sannyas. It's mentioned in this verse. Of course, when you hear that, the question arises, well, why are we taking sannyas? So the Prabhupada's explanation was, this is really about Mayavad sannyas. Vaishnava sannyas is a different thing. For preaching Krishna consciousness, then it's allowed. If you're going to use it to spread the glories of Krishna. And it's also a kind of precaution, because in Kali Yuga, so many people take sannyas who aren't qualified. India is full of sannyasis or babajis or sadhus wearing orange who have no spiritual qualification whatsoever. So they just it's just a show. In fact, it's a way of maintaining oneself. In the Lilamrita, there's a story about, I think Prabhupada made the observation that there was some neighbor of his, if I remember correctly, who during the day he had a job or something, then he would put on sannyas clothes and go out and beg, make money, because people would give money to a sadhu. So this was the occupation, sadhu. So this is why it said sannyas is one of the things that's forbidden in Kali Yuga. So especially this Ashwamedha Yajna, these different yajnas, in general these yajnas, they have no real efficacy in this age. They're supposed to be able to actually produce something. When you perform a sacrifice, you're supposed to actually get some results. That's the principle of sacrifice. You perform some ritual, and you get something in return. We use the example, it's just like when we want to, if we want to have the lights on in our house, or if we want to have a phone, so we have to perform a yajna. We have to give some money, we have to get, you know, maybe you sit down at your on your asana at your desk, you pull out your checkbook, you do this whole ritual, and you write things, and your name is the mantra. So, and then there's dakshina you give to the light company, so on. So you do all these, this ritual, and the lights come on. So in the same way, if you perform the Ashwamedha Yajna, then the rains come. Anat bhavanti bhutani parjanyadana sambhava. Yajyad bhavati parjanyo yajya karma sumudbhava. So this yajna, which is I found interesting in this verse, the yajna is performed specifically for that. Prabhupada says this is the duty of the king. Of course, we understand that the primary duty of the king is the spiritual progress of the people. That especially is missing in the common in the current age. The people are not being led. There's no spiritual leadership. So we tend to emphasize this. But a king also has other duties as part of his dharma as the king. And part of that duty is to make sure that people are fed. In fact, you can say, sometimes it's said, well, the first, you might say that's the first duty, because if you can't feed the people, then you can't give them spiritual enlightenment. So the king is like a guardian. He has to make sure that people are maintained materially, that they have their material protection and their spiritual protection. Or they're sustained and they're protected, but they're also enlightened. The king has a duty to do all of these things. So he has to make sure that people are fed. So that's why he has to perform yajna. Because the Bhagavad Gita says, by yajna the rains come. So he was doing this very dutifully, and he was especially doing it in the dry place. So then Prabhupada says, in Kali Yuga, we can't perform these Ashwamedha yajnas. So to get rain, we should perform Sankirtan Yajna. So I was reading this and I was thinking, oh gee, what Sankirtan Yajna means chanting the holy names. So why do we chant the holy names? We chant the holy names only for one reason, to develop Krishna Prema. So how is it that we can perform Sankirtan Yajna to get rain? That's a material thing. But apparently we can. Here it is right here. Prabhupada is telling us, you can chant for rain. In fact, I did some, I forget to bring it, I had some quotes from the Vedabase, Prabhupada, in different places where he says this exact thing. In fact, we know in general, we can say there's a general principle that Prabhupada would make, that if you chant Hare Krishna, everything will be taken care of. Your material and your spiritual needs will be taken care of. So there's kind of a side of us that knows this, you might say. We're chanting maybe without a care for that. Ideally, we want Krishna Prema. But we do know that if I chant Hare Krishna, Krishna will take care of me. So, of course, taking care of us means we have to eat. So if we perform Sankirtan Yajna, which is prescribed, then the rains will come. There's a nice letter also in this context. There was a drought going on in the Hyderabad, Madhya Pradesh, in that area. And the director of the forget what it was called. Like basically, it was the fundraising campaign was going on, government fundraising campaign, to get money to help people who were suffering because of this famine and drought that was going on. So Prabhupada received a letter from this minister, and the minister was asking Srila Prabhupada that when he was giving public lectures, they would ask people to give money toward this cause. So you might guess what Prabhupada's response was. He said, our contribution is chanting Hare Krishna. We perform Sankirtan Yajna. This is what causes rain. The people are suffering because of rain. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, if you have sacrifice, the rains will come. So this is what I encourage. And then he said, we have experience that there was a drought and we had a two-week festival and then it rained. So we have the proof. Prabhupada used to cite this as the proof. See, Bhagavad Gita is true. He used to also quote this verse, Anad Bhavanti Bhutani, to show that Bhagavad Gita is practical. It's not just theoretical, pie in the sky, otherworldly philosophy, but it's very practical. If you want to eat, Bhagavad Gita tells you how to eat, how you're going to eat, how you're going to get fed, by performing Sankirtan Yajna. So this is, we do this, we think. I remember we've done that once or twice here. Devotees have come and had kirtan during the day when there was some drought. And it's a little controversial. Oh, should we do this? Should we chant for rain? This sounds like Maya. But apparently it's not Maya. Prabhupada says this. Of course, when you hear this, you think, well, what other things can we do by chanting Hare? What else can we ask for? We can ask for rain. So we'd have to research the books, I guess, and see what kind of loopholes there are. But this we know for certain, because Prabhupada says it directly. You can chant Hare Krishna, Sankirtan Yajna, so that it will rain. You can do that. So Ambarish Maharaj was doing this. He was doing it in the dry places. But what I found interesting was that this line here at the end of the verse, Prabhupada says, let's see, what is it? What was the phrase? Ambarish. Oh, here. Maharaj Ambarish, as the head of the state, performed all these yajnas through great personalities like Vasishta, Gotama, and Asita. Personally, however, he was engaged in devotional service, as mentioned before. Savayamanat Krishna Padaravindayo. If you take this literally, it means that the Ashwamedha Yajna was not devotional service. So in a sense, you could say, well, it wasn't directly, but it is. I mean, a yajna, isn't a yajna devotional service? But it seems like Prabhupada is putting it in a slightly lower category as a kind of dharma that's performed as your, you might say, your material duty. You have to feed people. So that's, in some sense, you might say it's, of course, we like to broaden the umbrella. Anything that's done as service to Krishna is devotional service. But then there's specifically Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam, and so on. So this was his prime concentration, his prime meditation, his prime goal in life. But still, he performed his duty. So it's a little bit of a fine line that's being drawn here, it seems, because we would say, well, anything that you do, your dharma, that's devotional service, especially if you're doing it for Krishna. Our dharma. In fact, even our karma, I was thinking of these two words as they're used in Bhagavad Gita, how they work, because even in this verse, Andad Bhavanti Bhutani, so Yajna Bhavati, Yajna Karma Samudbhava, the last line of the verse. So it says, to get rain, you have to perform sacrifice, and to perform and performing sacrifice is your prescribed duty, is born of prescribed duty. So you might think the word to be used there would be dharma. It's your dharma to perform yajna, but the word used is karma, actually. Now, this is not so surprising when you think of this other verse, karmanyevadikaraste. Krishna says earlier, you have a right to perform your karma. Sometimes you'll hear Indian people talk about doing their karmas. So I was thinking of the relationship between these two. It almost seems as if dharma is kind of the broad. We all have our dharma, varnashram dharma, where we're situated. So within that dharma, we have our specific karmas, the specific things that we have to perform. And Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, karmanyevadikaraste, adhikar, this word adhikar, which I always get disturbed that people mispronounce it in the Tulsi prayer, seva adhikara diye koro nija dasi, not seva adhikoro diye. The word there is adhikar. Give me the privilege of devotional service. So privilege or right Krishna says, karman yeva dikaraste. You certainly have a right to perform your prescribed duty. Mapale shukadachana, of course, then he says, but you don't have a right to be attached to the fruit. Do your work, but the fruit must be offered to Krishna. So this is karma yoga. What is karma yoga? It doesn't mean ordinary karma. The word yoga, of course, means to connect. When you connect your karma to Krishna, then it becomes devotional service, dharma. It becomes sanatana dharma, which is bhakti yoga, devotional service. So all of these things are connected here, making some fine distinctions, but they're all part of devotional service. We can say Ambarish Maharaj, just like Prabhupada, everything he did was devotional service. He always spoke about Krishna. There's some of you may have heard this one tape where Prabhupada was talking about how beautiful the women were in different places. What does he say? Kashmir, I think. Beautiful black hair. The women have beautiful black hair. For some reason, Prabhupada was talking about this. I don't remember what the context was. It was on a morning walk. And then I think it was Yadubar who says, Krishna has beautiful black hair. And Prabhupada says, oh yes, that's good, you're a devotee. Said, but so there we're just talking, this Maya here we're talking. Something. So devotee always brings it back to Krishna. So everything Prabhupada talked about, ultimately it was in the context of teaching us some lesson about Krishna. So Maharaj Ambarish, from one point of, in other words, there may have been karma kandis performing Ashwamedha yagyas. No doubt there were karma kandis performing Ashwamedha yagyas. But Ambarish Maharaj, as a devotee of Krishna, everything he did was under the umbrella of bhakti yoga, devotional service to the Supreme Lord. So I'll read the translation again. In desert countries where there flowed the river Saraswati, Maharaj Ambarish performed great sacrifices like the Ashwamedha Yajna, and thus satisfied the master of all yajnas, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such sacrifices were performed with great opulence and suitable paraphernalia, and with contributions of dakshina to the brahmanas, who were supervised by great personalities like Vasishta, Asita, and Gautama, representing the king, the performer of the sacrifices. Any questions? I specifically brought a clock so I wouldn't talk too long, but I talked too long. There's no clock out here anymore.
So you mentioned...
Yes, Prabhu.
I got the mic.
Achyutananda Prabhu.
In discussing or describing the structure of the universe, I would give an example, because some devotees said, oh, there's no river. I can't believe that there's a river going up and down from the higher and lower planets. And my example was, if you look at, let's say, a subway map of New York, and you see 42nd Street and 7th Avenue, you just see lines and numbers. You can't tell that that's the show entertainment center of the world. You have to know that that's what's going on there. But the maps, if it says Wall Street and John Street, those are just lines on the map. But there's rivers of money and influence flowing out of these places. So they're subtle. That's all.
I was going to say that when we were working on correcting the fifth canto during May, June, July, in 77, and Prabhupada would come in periodically with these big maps. So at one point, I mentioned to Tamal, I said, you know, it says there that Kashmir and these places correspond to these various varshas. That totally contradicts fifth canto, because how could that be? There's 16,000 miles worth of Himalayas between and all that. So he mentioned the problem. The problem said, well, that should be edited out. So I don't know if it ever was in the new books. I don't know if it trickled down. A lot of corrections, I don't know if they ever really trickled down.
There are several places where Prabhupada mentions that the seven continents are the seven dweeps.
That's another thing, yeah. But as far as the varshas,
where Ketumala Varsha and Ilavrita Varsha, where these varshas are.
And I specifically asked, these things are subtle, and he said, yes, can't perceive it. No.
Actually, Sariputta has shown how there are three different ways that you can analyze the way the fifth canto presents.
Especially because
one was the solar system, one was the where it's just the Earth, and there was a third one.
Sumeru is like 800,000 miles tall. I said, Prabhupada, wouldn't we be able to see that?
Yeah,
that's pretty big.
Now, the very beginning of that description in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam says that even if you lived forever, you'll never be able to understand the structure of the universe. So it's very complex and multidimensional. So that's probably the problem why Prabhupada presented it, because it's like you have to have higher perceptions in order to really understand it. So he simplified it for us.
And we still don't know where Manu lives.
We should ask Manu Das, maybe he knows. Yes.
But as Prabhupada says, if it looks like it's a contradiction, it's because you don't have enough knowledge. It's poor for enough knowledge.
Yeah, that's
not
principle.
Enough knowledge. So that's why it looks sometimes like a contradiction, but it's not there.
Yeah,
it's like the moon, the sun, and the moon planets. Prabhupada says the moon is beyond, but it looks like a contradiction from the material point of view.
Yeah, sometimes said that those with broader minds or like Mahatma, broader intelligence, they can accommodate contradictions. Whereas simple-minded, small-minded persons get all disturbed by it because they don't have a broader perspective on it.
I was listening to a lecture by Srila Prabhupada the other day, and he was talking about at one time in Calcutta there was an epidemic of typhoid, and it was running through the city. And so a sannyasi took a kirtan party out, and he went around chanting Hare Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to help the situation, and it may or may not have worked, I don't remember that part, but Prabhupada said this was Nama Aparad.
He said that?
Yes. He said to use the holy name for a material purpose. So how is that different than chanting for rain?
I don't know how it's different. I just know the Prabhupada says it's okay. He says in quite a few, in several different places, he says, if people want rain, they should perform Sankirtan Yajna. Now, one way to look at it is that this is the Yajna for the age. In every age, there are Yajnas. So you might look at it for society in general. This is the prescribed Yajna for everything, for all of our prosperity in this age. And we as Vaishnavas, of course, we want to take it to a deeper level for our own purification. But still, it seems to be there, and even in places where Prabhupada doesn't seem to qualify it at all, he just says, perform Sankirtan Yajna and the rains will come. Lakshmi Monikuru?
I guess you can consider what you do when you get the rain, or what you do when the, when the epidemic's over. If the person uses the mantra to cure the epidemic and then everybody just goes about their merry old way, engaged in totally materialistic activities, then that's an aparad. If there's no attempt to, because it goes on here to explain, and of course we know with Srila Prabhupada that Ambarish, you know, he took care of the material needs of his citizens, but he was also very concerned and more concerned about their spiritual needs. So in order for somebody to advance in spiritual life, material needs have to be met. But if you're just going to take care of material needs and let them go about, you know, being in Maya, then what's the use of that?
Right. We always go for the full solution, not just temporary. Yes.
I'm just curious to know, for the sake of spreading the holy name, is it an aparad to get people to chant and encourage them to chant because it'll make them more peaceful without, I mean, if it's too much for you to say, like, oh, it'll help you develop love of God, it'll cleanse your heart from all of the, like, to tell someone, oh, it'll help you calm down, it'll help you, is that an aparad?
It's a little tricky, actually. I'll give you an example, an anecdote of something that took place in Back to Godhead many years ago. There was always the endeavor, because Back to God was being distributed to the public, like tens of thousands of magazines, So devotees were always trying to make it relevant to people and appeal to people. So there were a couple of issues where they had people chanting, and then they had basically material constant, you know, people said, I chant Hare Krishna. When I chant Hare Krishna before I go to work, it charges my batteries and I'm ready for the day. So there were quotes like that. So Prabhupada actually didn't like that very much. And in fact, what he said, people have to, now this all took place at the same time that in Hawaii, there was Siddhasarup's group who was emphasizing chanting but not following the regulative principles. It was like, just get them to chant and don't really mention the principles. So Prabhupada says, no, we always have to make this point that chanting, you have to get people to chant, but it has to be chanted according to prescribed method in order for it to be effective. So he wanted that to get through to people, that you have to understand, you have to chant, but you have to chant and follow the rules, or otherwise it'll, he said in one place, he said, it'll take them 300 births to get results if they think they don't have to follow the rules. Now, if we're just introducing someone, he said, gee, just get them to chant somehow or other. Now, Prabhupada would also use phrases like that. Somehow or other, engage them in devotional service. I remember we used to, we'd be driving around, we'd just stop someone on the street and ask them, can you tell me how to get to Govinda Street? And they would say, Govinda Street? He'd say, yeah, we got them to chant Hare Krishna. So we try somehow or other to get people to chant Hare Krishna. So I think there is some leeway there. Now, especially like when you're distributing books, if you're going to give them as a follow-up some literature on Krishna consciousness, then that's very good. So I think it's okay as long as, you know, gradually, not very, you might say very quickly, people come to understand that this is really for spiritual purification. And I, you know, generally when we present Krishna consciousness, we get to the spiritual aspect pretty quickly. You know, people know what we're about. So again, it's a little bit dangerous. I think we have to be careful with it because that principle is there that Prabhupada was quite strong about. He also didn't want sahajyas, just chanting and without following rules. So it's important that people understand that. All right, we're past our time. We'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.